The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to open the cover one last time on Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina for November 2022. Our theme this month has been Carolina Born and Bred, seven stories of our state animals. We'll get to a couple more today, but first, being the last reading of the month, I'm necessarily going to be reading to you from the article series, The 1980s, The Decade of Local Heroes. A man of grand designs, Harvey Gantt, arrives in Charlotte as a leader with vision, helping shape the city's future as an architect and following his election in 1983 as its first black mayor. Written by Philip Gerard. Harvey Grant was the friendly kid who handed out apples to his playmates when they got bored, just to keep them hanging around shooting marbles in his yard in Charleston, South Carolina. "I like being around people," he explains to an interviewer with a Southern oral history program years later. That's after he made history as the first black mayor of Charlotte. His affable manner and ability to get along well with nearly anybody and an instinct to bring people together will serve both his artistic talent and his steadfast determination to succeed at his chosen profession, architecture. And it becomes one of his greatest assets as a politician and leader. He maintains, "I just always have this confidence that if I can get you to sit down and look you in the eye, we can talk. We can get to know each other." Gantt was born on the Yonge Island near Charleston, the first of five children. The family moved to the city, where his father worked as a rigger mechanic at the Navy Yard during the war years. They first reside in public housing, then in a home that Gantt's father built by hand, learning carpentry as he went, Gantt recalls. "Probably I got my first interest in architecture by remembering that he built that house himself, and the house sort of grew with the family." His teachers saw his promise early. They skipped him past first grade and enrolled him in second grade. And when they noted his constant doodling rather than punishing him, they praised the quality of his drawings and encouraged him. "I'm one of those fortunate people who early on recognized that I wanted to be an architect, and that was in ninth grade," he tells interviewers. "I can't even remember wanting to do anything else other than design things for people." Charleston, like the rest of the South, was a segregated city. Schooled by his father, a member of the NAACP, Gantt took an interest in the strange contradictions of the world around him. Their neighborhood was integrated, yet kids of different races were not supposed to play together, a rule impossible to enforce. White and colored drinking fountains in public spaces reminded everyone of the separation. After the all-black Burke High School, Gantt and a cadre of friends were inspired when four students from the Agriculture and Technical College of North Carolina staged a sit-in at the Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro. The Charleston County School Board had recently banned students from taking part in any demonstrations during school hours, but on the chosen day, April 1st, 1960, Burke was closed because the teachers were attending a meeting in Columbia. The initial plan was to stage the sit-in at Woolworth, emulating the A&T students. But, wary of events in Greensboro repeating themselves in Charleston, police were stationed outside of the department store so that the students reverted to Plan B, the lunch counter at S.H. Kress & Company on King Street. They were a few students. Orderly and courteous, they recited psalms and the Lord's Prayer and sat tight, even when workers poured ammonia on the countertop in an effort to drive them out. We sat down at S.H. Kress's lunch tower counter. After planning to do so for about 3 or 4 weeks, in selecting our students very carefully, Aunt recounts, we trained ourselves to resist the ridicule we would experience. The Charleston Post and Courier details what happened next. Police Chief William F. Kelly ordered the building cleared at 4:45 p.m. after an anonymous caller told police a bomb was scheduled to go off any minute. A search of the building failed to reveal a bomb. Kelly ordered a security guard placed around the building last night. Police were arrested all 24 of the demonstrators and held them in the courthouse before releasing each of their parents on $10 bail and $24 total court costs, paid by the Charleston branch of the NAACP. The sit-in ignited the Charleston movement. More sit-ins and boycotts of stores that would not hire black workers, which would eventually help end segregation in Charleston. After graduation, Gant won a scholarship into Iowa State University, an integrated school, an impossibility in his home state. He reasoned that because most architects were white, he would need to have access to both white and black mentors to get the best education in the field. But the only other black students he saw there were athletes. Standing in line to register for classes, he himself was assumed to be a football player, which he found degrading. Before long, he applied to Clemson University, which offered an excellent architectural program. I mean, there are times when truth itself sort of snaps its head straight up in my face, and you know that you've got to go in a different direction, he explains. And it was nice to make that decision on a 23 below zero day in Iowa. But when Clemson received his transcripts from all-black Burke High School, where he had graduated second in his class, the university rejected him. Gant turned to Matthew Perry, the lawyer who had helped him and his classmates with their sit-in arrests, and filed suit, backed by the NAACP, Legal Defense Fund. Gant lost the suit, but won on appeal, and thus became the first black student enrolled at Clemson. Before long, he was joined by Lucinda Browley, a young woman he had met while speaking to local high schools, the first black woman to attend Clemson. Their friendship blossomed into love, and they were married in the fall of 1964. The following spring, Gant graduated third in his class of fellow architects, then joined the firm of Odell Associates in Charlotte. The first time I saw Charlotte, I fell in love with it, he says. It had an air about it that just said, hey, here's a place that's growing. You might want to be able to grow with it. He went on to earn a master's degree in city planning from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, then worked for about 18 months as senior planner on the Soul City project, Floyd McKissick's quixotic attempt to create a model integrated city in Warren County. Floyd's idea of a new town where you built an economic base as an alternative to welfare state appealed to me, Gant recalls. Ultimately, the project was doomed by lack of business investment and hostile press. Gant returned to Charlotte in 1971 to partner with Jeff Huberman in Gant Huberman Architects. The firm focused not just on building structures, but also on crafting larger designs that encouraged a strong sense of community. Gant Huberman's legacy is built into Charlotte's civic identity, the Charlotte Transportation Center, Transamerica Square, Imagine On, Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, and the Johnson C. Smith University Science Center. Gant joins a task force addressing planning and development in the city, and soon he is a recognized leader and appointed to fill the unexpired term of Fred Alexander, the only black member on the city council. That appointment leads to three more elected terms, and he's named Mayor Pro Tem in 1981. In 1983, Gant is elected Charlotte's first black mayor with 52% of the vote and serves two terms. Ironically, many of the same white people who vote for segregationist Jesse Helms for Senate also vote for Gant, a contradiction that Gant does not find so surprising. What I've noticed in Charlotte is that people believe me. They don't agree always with me. But when I say it, they believe it. And they don't believe I'm putting them on, he tells an interviewer with the Southern Oral History Program. Under Gant's leadership, encouraging cooperation rather than confrontation, Charlotte prospers. He works to preserve neighborhoods and revitalize the downtown center. He leaves behind a citywide recycling program, a balanced budget, and a new NBA basketball franchise, the Hornets. Gant's philosophy of leadership is straightforward. When you've got the people sort of working together, you can get them to put away their thing for our thing, that is, the city. He aims to turn hard-won racial and social progress into durable institutional change. In 1990, he challenges three-term incumbent Senator Jesse Helms on health care and education. Some people are always trying to tear things down, Gant says in his campaign ad. I'm an architect, and we build things. Helms unleashes a series of television ads that stoke white voters' fears about losing their jobs to affirmative action. Behind in the polls, until the ad runs just before election, Helms claims a narrow victory. Still, Gant wins 47% of the vote. Gant's reputation in his city remains as durable as the many signature structures he designed. The Charlotte Post honors him with his 2007 Lifetime Achievement Award, and the City Center Partners give him its 2008 Vision Award. Perhaps most significant is the Harvey B. Gant Center for African American Arts and Culture, which opens in 2009. Gant writes about his initial reluctance to have his name so prominently featured, but ultimately accepts it. I thought about the enormous history of the residents of the historic Second Ward community of Brooklyn, where the Gant Center now stands, he writes. Brooklyn residents often referred to the old Myers School as the Jacob Ladder School. Its skyward stairway was a visible reminder of the importance of aspiring to greater things and a good education. Not just teachers, but an entire community rallied behind the youth, molding bright blind minds, encouraging their resolve, letting them doodle their way into their own grand design. Coming in December, a white Christmas on the coast. Well, let's see. What are we going to have time for here? Well, let's start with the first, and we'll see where we end up. The state freshwater trout is our brook trout, a tale of two fishes. We have the state saltwater fish, which is the channel bass. So we have the state fish being divided into freshwater and saltwater. One scaly swimming symbol alone could not tell the full story of our waters. Our state fishes represent two facets of North Carolina's personality, two sides of a southern coin. One is meditative as a remote mountain stream. The other is fiercely headstrong as the wild Atlantic. You can't even call them kissing cousins, not really. Scientifically speaking, the brook trout and the red drum, a.k.a. redfish, channel bass, puppy drum, and plain old red, split way down the taxonomic tree trunk long ago. They are as different as a ruby-throated hummingbird and a great blue heron. But they are forever yoked in as at least one regard. They are each a formal ambassador of North Carolina's astonishing natural wonder. The Southern Appalachian strain of brook trout is our official state freshwater trout, and the red drum is our official state saltwater fish. A kinship anchored in the deep ways that they are tied to their specific Tar Heel habitats. And while they might be almost as different as night and day, each inspires a singular passion for the wild places where they thrive. Ask any angler who pursues either of these fish. When a brook trout or a red drum is on the line, it feels like you've hooked a little piece of the heart and soul of North Carolina. I hike and hike, and I climb some more. I want to get a solid mile away from the truck and up the creek before I even think about wetting a line. To find a brook trout in North Carolina, you very nearly have to find yourself halfway to lost. Their scientific name, Salvelinus fontanellus, includes a reference to the Latin word for springs. They haunt the high headwater creeks, the tiny brooks that trickle and trellis through the mossy quiet of cathedral forests. Once there, you have to thread a cast under overhanging rhododendron into current seams of water that seem to flow like molten onyx in shadows that never give way to the sun. During the Pleistocene epoch, brook trout were pushed down from the northeast by glaciers. When the ice receded, they found in the pure, high-elevation stream of southern Appalachia. The other trout of North Carolina, rainbow and brown, are regal beasts, but are nonetheless imposters, having been stocked in our mountain streams for more than a century. And both of these fish are more aggressive and typically larger than brookies, so they will harass and outcompete our native trout. Today, brook trout have been driven to the highest, smallest headwaters, almost all above 3,000 feet in elevation, and often upstream of tall waterfalls that blunt the migration of rainbows and browns. That's one reason anglers cherish the brook trout. They can only be found in the last wild places. They can only be caught by those willing to climb and crawl and cast into ungodly tangles. And for all that trouble, half a foot of wiggle and squirm is the likely prize. But what a prize it is. In the hand, a brook trout feels like a quivering, luminescent colors of a kaleidoscope have somehow been fashioned into flesh. The fish is speckled with red spots, many encircled with blue halos. Yellow vermiculations squirm across the moss-green back, and the belly of a breeding male is often swathed in a stripe of orange. In the hand, the fish seems gaudy, a piscine peacock, but in the water, this spotted predator disappears, its yellow-slashed back nearly invisible against the sun-dappled stream bottom. They don't grow as large as other trout. They often don't fight as hard as other fish, but the allure of this dweller of springs lies in its ancient bearing, unchanged for centuries. They live beyond the end of the trail, on the far side of the ridge, just below the clouds that snag into the tallest poplars. You have to go big for this tiniest of North Carolina trout. Now, to be honest, your average, ordinary, everyday redfish might smirk at a brook trout. Red drum are a bit on the brutish side, brawny and headstrong and chock full of attitude. Maybe it's best that these two tar-heeled standard bearers could never cross paths. Far from the high country, the redfish loves a small tidal creek, and on the high tides they'll bury through flooded marsh in search of shrimp and crabs like a puppy trying to sniff out the last cookie crumb in the carpet. But redfish are just as happy in crashing surf, cruising rough water shoals, or brooding in deep water sloughs in broad tidal rivers. Fishing for brook trout involves immersing yourself in a cloistered, calming atmosphere. Casting for redfish can require putting yourself out on the wild edge of terra firma, sunk to your waist in the waves, or clutching a boat railing as you cut the distance to a redfish school crashing bait on the surface. Redfish can be found in North Carolina year-round, but they're not always where they were last week or yesterday or even this morning, and that explains much of their allure to anglers. To fish for channel bass is to hunt for channel bass. The fish are tied to the tides, the rising waters that allow them to push deep into marsh and oyster reef, and the falling waters that pull prey out of the shadows and into deeper waters. Anglers cruise quietly in boats and kayaks and on foot, searching for the shape and shadows of redfish on the feed, or better yet, the flashing tails of channel bass grubbing in the particularly submerged seagrass. Even in the surf, when sight casting isn't possible, fishing for red drum requires hunting the beach for the shore breaks and sloughs and channels that hold fish. Like the brook trout, which might live most of its days in a shady pool, the size of a living room, redfish live life on the move. And it's only when you lift the red drum out of the water that you grasp its extraordinary beauty. Submerged redfish appear the color of marsh water or roiled surf. But out of the water or in the clearest marsh ponds, they gleam gold and copper and russet. They appear gilded as if some artisan hammered them out of bronze. Small constellations of eye spots, called ocelli, speckle their tails and flanks. Likely an evolutionary adaptation to escape being eaten, the eye spots draw predators' attention to the wrong end of the fish. Those striking eye spots are one reason these fish engender such passion among anglers. The other is that they care not a whit to be out of the water, so they put up a valiant, rod-bending, heart-thrumping fight when hooked. And that's why along the salt marsh and the sandy shore at the very edge of North Carolina, it's often the angler that gets caught. And I think we have time for one more. We're going to have to skip the one on the Spanish Mustang and go to the state reptile, the eastern box turtle. Why did the turtle cross the road? Turns out, it was following the homing instinct that forever draws it back to where it was born. Across the state, citizen scientists collect data that may help protect this beloved reptile and sometimes lend a hand to turtles in trouble. Meredith Brooks has a special attachment to Finch, a 15-year-old eastern box turtle. She first met him in 2011 when a neighbor brought him to her after the young turtle was run over by a car. His shell was split, and Brooks thought to herself, this is probably going to be a miracle turtle that's going to make it. She took him to a veterinarian that had a special interest in the treatment of reptiles, who administered antibiotics and used epoxy to glue his shell back together. While Finch recovered, Brooks kept him in her turtle habitat in her home in Transylvania County, where he gained weight quickly and continued to mature. After 3 or 4 years, he started mating with other turtles in the habitat, and Brooke knew that it was time to get him back into the wild. She glued a radio transmitter to the back of his shell and released him close to where he was hit, but safely away from the road. Brooks, along with her mentor, Steve McO'Neill, is a citizen scientist working with the Box Turtle Connection, a statewide project chaired by Dr. Ann Barry Somers, a senior lecturer emerita at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Brooks and O'Neill were introduced through a mutual acquaintance who knew that they were both interested in turtles, and together they became involved with the Box Turtle Connection, through which they capture, mark, and release turtles in Transylvania and Henderson counties. The data they collect contributes to an understanding of box turtle populations with the goal of species conservation. In addition to the project, the pair educates others about box turtles, including what to do if you find one in the wild and how to protect this declining species. Brooks and O'Neill have both loved turtles since they were kids. When Brooks was 5, she built a turtle motel, complete with a beach and a little turtle condo made of bricks. She now understands that turtles are wild animals that should not be kept as pets. But, she says, I did what kids do. I didn't know any better. O'Neill felt a connection to turtles because, as a self-proclaimed introverted kid, he often withdrew into his own shell. He loved all reptiles, but box turtles are his favorite. They have this ancient quality about them, he says, like a wise old man sitting in the forest contemplating existence. The eastern box turtle is the only terrestrial turtle native to North Carolina. They are commonly found across the state, except for the Outer Banks, and most often in forested areas where their splotchy shells, typically a mixture of brown, yellow, orange, and red, help them blend in with leaf litter. Box turtles have a strong homing instinct, which is why you should never pick one up in the wild and take it home, or move a turtle any farther than across the road. When a box turtle is removed from its home, it becomes stressed, and it can more easily catch diseases, lose weight, and die. It's not necessarily that they're going to try to get home, Steve says, but they're in a stressed-out state because nothing is familiar to them. So O'Neill says if you find a turtle trying to cross the road, simply help it across in the direction it's headed. They know where to go. They know where they're going. They have an agenda. Cars are just one threat posed by humans that box turtles face. They like to hide in tall grass, so lawnmowers can be deadly. O'Neill recommends keeping grass short, as well as mowing during the hottest part of the day, when turtles are more likely to be buried in leaves and dirt to stay cool. People taking them home as pets is another big problem. The practice not only stresses the turtle, but it also removes them from the breeding population, and it's illegal. Turtles adapt to every environmental condition that nature could throw at them for millions of years. They were here before dinosaurs, O'Neill says, and then we come along. They have a lot of trouble adapting to us. People who find turtles injured by cars, mowers, or anything else often bring them to the Brooks or O'Neill to rehabilitate them. Once the turtles are healed, if they're able to survive in the wild, they're released near where they were found. Between the two of them, Brooks and O'Neill have rehabbed and released hundreds of box turtles. If a turtle can't be released, either because it was too badly injured to survive in the wild or because no one knows where it came from, one of the two will keep it. Brooks currently has two box turtles that live permanently in her habitat. O'Neill has six. Every few days between spring and fall, when box turtles are most active, Brooks tracks Finch to find out where he is and what he's up to. Today, O'Neill is with her, and he punches a number that corresponds to the turtle's transmitter into a radio. The radio beeps as he points it in four directions, and he and Brooks begin walking in the direction where it beeps the loudest. As they get closer, the beeps get even louder. With his yellow and brown shell, Finch blends in with the forest floor, and O'Neill and Brooks have to look hard to find him. When Brooks spots Finch, she picks him up. His shell is a little misshapen from being split, but otherwise he's a healthy box turtle. As Brooks holds him, he stretches his neck out as far as it will go, his feet clawing at the air. This is a turtle that wants to be on the move. He's so viral, Brooks says, he needs to be in the wild doing his own thing. For more information about the box turtle connection, visit boxturtle.uncg.edu. Well, you hear the music coming up in the background that says we only have a minute left to talk, so I'll read a couple of ads here. This comes from the Our State Made in North Carolina Awards. Congratulations to the 2022 winners. Visit ourstate.com/madeinnc to learn more about this year's winners and honorable mentions. In the craft category, genres collection by Bright Black. The drink collection is Blueberry Basil June, J-U-N, by Shanti Elixirs, LLC. The food category, Lamb Salami by Sun Raised Food. Home and garden category, Large Grilling Set by Robinson X-Files Knives. And the style category, an Asheville Outdoor Community Series, From Farm to Feet, a Nestor Hosiery Brand. And there are pictures of each of them here. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, enough so that you'll be ready to listen to us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.